Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Professor of Mathematics and Computer Science at Dartmouth College, Dan Rockmore, and we're talking about his latest book, Stalking the Riemann Hypothesis, The Quest to Find the Hidden Law of Prime Numbers. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here, Mark.
Now, you have to admit that as soon as you say that you're doing a show about mathematics, you can hear all the radio like clicking up.
I want to encourage to their next rock and roll station.
Well, I want to encourage people to listen, because primes and the Riemann hypothesis is actually fascinating, and I want to mostly talk about the end of the book, but I wanted to keep the audience up to speed. Let's go through the basics. Prime numbers, what are they?
So primes are numbers that are only divisible by themselves in one, and so from that sort of outlook, mathematicians view them as basically the atoms of arithmetic, since you can make any number by multiplying together a collection of prime numbers. And in fact, there's a unique way to write any number as a product of prime numbers. So they're really the fundamental numerical pieces.
And that's the first time I think I've ever read in any of the books on mathematics that describing primes as the atoms. And that really is a wonderful sort of a very evocative image about the primes.
Yeah, well, it's a natural sort of thing to do from a scientific point of view. You know, once you decide you want to study numbers, just like, you know, once you decide you want to study, you know, pieces of the universe, you want to figure out what the smallest pieces are. I mean, I guess it's a Western thing, you know, the reductionist approach. But you are led to them pretty quickly, and so you see them, you know, having popped up as an object of study, sort of, in many different cultures.
What's amazing is, in reading your book, tracing the history of people grappling with the patterns of large-scale primes is really the history of mathematics. The greatest minds in mathematics, especially in the last 200 years, have all tried to deal with, is there a pattern to the large-scale primes? And it is it's almost as if every mathematician inevitably ends up knocking horns with primes.
Yeah, so the other thing about number theory and the primes in particular, again, is that I think most mathematicians do start out, you know, interested in numbers. Mathematics traces its beginnings back to an interest in either numbers or an interest in shapes. And for every mathematician, it's almost a rite of passage, I think, to be interested in numbers in some way. And then if you're, you know, as you get older and you acquire more and more knowledge of mathematics, then you become interested, you know, is there a pattern? You know, can you say anything about primes generally? I don't happen to be a number theorist, but I went through my own little
prime phase.
Yeah, I mean, more or less. I mean, in graduate school, in fact, and it just turned out it wasn't for me.
Is this like
really
listening?
I have to say that generally speaking, number theory is, I mean, it's called the queen of mathematics, and so it gets the greatest minds in there.
It also seems addictive. I mean, people are so close to understanding that pattern that they just seem like it's got to be there.
Yeah, I mean, you look, and then you think, well, maybe I could be the one who cracks it. You know, I could be the one who really figures out what the pattern is. But it's a pretty hard problem. It certainly has sort of stood the test of time.
Well, let's go over some interesting facts for people who are not number theorists or people who are not mathematicians. When they hear about numbers that are only divisible by one in themselves, I think a lot of people would logically say, well, that's a finite set of numbers, that once the numbers get large enough, those big numbers certainly have to be divisible by more numbers than one in itself. And in fact, that's not true. And that goes all the way back to Euclid. Euclid had a proof for the infinitude of primes.
Yes, yes. So, I think you're right. It's definitely not something that's obvious.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would be.
Right. I mean, and again, I mean, just looking at the infinities or sort of the uncountable things that we know of. If you think of people, for example, as being, you know, of every possible variety, but then if you believe that, you know, everything is in the genome, well, the genome is just constructed of four letters, right? Those, that's our genetic sequence. But, you know, nevertheless, we seem to keep spewing out different kinds of people.
There are a couple of assumptions that I think the average person would make, okay, that there is a finite number of primes, that if in fact there's an infinity of primes, that as you go up the numbers, that the number of primes would become less and less and less, and there'd be some kind of pattern. If you were to graph these primes, it would be a certain kind of curve.
Right.
But that isn't exactly known.
No, it's not. And that's, that's the mystery that underlies this thing called the Riemann hypothesis. There is a pattern that actually, if you start to plot them out, you know, just by using, by counting them, basically, you will begin to see this curve, but then you'll also see these weird hiccups, like there are these things called twin primes, so primes that are only separated by two numbers, like 17 and 19 are twin primes. But these twin primes actually seem to appear infinitely often. So even when you think you're sort of on to a pattern, all of a sudden you can be out, you know, around a trillion, and then you'll get two primes that are, you know, practically right next to each other. So,
but even the sense that there are this infinitude of twin primes just makes you feel that much that there's got to be a pattern to this that's knowable.
Well, that certainly has driven a lot of people. Driven them in any of a number of directions, I suppose.
Well, let's talk about Riemann himself and what the Riemann hypothesis is.
So Riemann was a mathematician who worked in the 19th century, and besides his contributions to number theory, he's known also for great contributions to geometry, mathematical physics, all sorts of other areas. But he wrote only one paper on number theory, and a very short paper, an 8-page paper. And in this paper, he laid down what I would say are the foundations for the way in which people have studied the way the primes are distributed since that time, which was in 1859. It ends up being a little technical, but what he was able to do was sort of encode the pattern of the primes in some mathematical function. Now, so function will probably make people turn the radio elsewhere, but...
Let's stay with this. And I think we should explain this, because the whole key to your book, and especially to all the later research on this patterns of primes, is the zeta zeros, the zeta function. And so let's spend some time talking about Riemann's zeta function and what it means. And you describe it as a number theorist's PDA.
A function for a mathematician is simply a machine that where you put numbers in one end and numbers come out the other end. And so a very simple example of a function would be the squaring function. You put 2 in, it shoots out 4. You put 3 in, it shoots out 9. And so Riemann created this other kind of function called the zeta function. And there's a sense in which... So I describe it as a PDA. So you can think of this thing as having knobs on it. And basically, every time you twiddle the knobs, you could see a different number, if you like, on the readout. And so these knobs correspond to things called complex numbers. What Riemann figured out is that if he could understand when you could dial in a zero using these knobs, then he would understand how the primes are distributed. Now, there's a long chain of being in between that description and the primes. But the essence is that he sort of found this very terse description, if you like, of the behavior of the primes, but encoded in this funny way. And that's really his outstanding breakthrough.
But was that a proof? That wasn't a proof.
It wasn't. So there are a couple interesting things about that question, because in the mid-1800s, we didn't have a different sense of proof, but sometimes papers would be written different kinds of ways. I mean, now, you know, if listeners remember in high school having taken a geometry class where, you know, axiomatic geometry, you have your axioms and then you grind through in some mechanical way to truths at the end. Mathematicians didn't write papers like that as frequently in the mid 1800s. You know, you could sort of write almost a memo. You know, I think things are going to go this way. And so Riemann's paper has a little bit of that. You know, there's sort of indications, directions, and not actually sewing up every last fact in there. So his paper contains a description, explicit description of this zeta function, as well as you know, hypotheses or conjectures about what's going to be true with respect to this zeta function. So the construction's there, and he says what he believes is true, and he gives pretty strong, I mean, so he gives a lot of directions towards how to prove it explicitly, but it seemed to be in this paper, which was just a note, you know, that he must have felt like he was really laying the foundations for something, and he was going to leave it to other people to chase down the loose ends.
And this is what has really captured the imagination and the work and the time of mathematicians right up until today, that it seems like it's there, but the proof has not really been gotten yet, right?
Yeah, I mean, so it seems like it's there in the sense that, you know, Riemann certainly did a lot of work before he posed his conjecture, in the sense that, so this conjecture is about when is this complicated function equal to zero. So he did some computations, and I'm sure that he had many other reasons for having said that, you know, every time it's zero, the following thing is true of the inputs. And in fact, years later, somebody went through his notebooks, and they found all sorts of derivations and different kinds of formulas that gave the same thing as the zeta function. So Riemann had a very deep understanding of this. Of this construction, but it seemed to be in this one little note that I mean, he wasn't going to pour out his soul. You know, he sort of had, okay, I want to write 8 pages. I'm going to say it and be done with it. and that's what he did. And then he just got on to something else.
It seems so frustrating.
Yeah, well, mathematics is frustrating even for mathematicians. That's the thing that I hope people can start to appreciate. You know, it's a lot of people get turned off to mathematics because they think, well, I'm not one of the people for whom it's easy. But the truth of it is that it's not even easy for mathematicians. They're just intrigued by it. They're intrigued by these patterns, by these connections, by the objects of study, and it keeps them going. When other people's interests start to move in different directions, but it's frustrating for all of us. I can promise you that.
Getting through your book, and it's interesting in reading all the different mathematicians who've worked on this problem. As a non-mathematician, I was left with mathematicians are convinced that there is a knowable pattern in all these things.
Yeah,
but suppose, I mean, is it possible that there is not a knowable pattern?
So it's certainly possible that we won't ever know any better the pattern than we know it today.
I mean, we know different aspects and parameters of what appears to be a pattern.
Yes.
But is it possible we can just never pin it down exactly?
Yeah, it's totally possible. It could be, you know, it could be one of those things, you know, one of those goals that's always just as far from you as it is at any other day, you know, always reaching for it and never quite grabbing it. You know, those sorts of statements are out there in mathematics, and I mean that's sort of one of the ramifications of Gödel's work on incompleteness. You know, you can pose statements that may not have proofs in either direction.
But it seems like the ramifications of accepting that are profound. Does that mean that everybody just quits and goes home? I mean,
the thing is that you never know. And, you know, sometimes that's not so important. I mean, it's sort of in the process, other things are discovered, and if there is such a problem and its main effect is that it leads people to all sorts of other interesting mathematics, then, I mean, it's great in its own right, even though we never reach it. I mean, we never reach the end of it. I mean, in that sense, mathematics shares something with other sciences, you know. And I mean, we can have a theory of the universe, but there could be an experiment tomorrow that overturns today's theory. Sure. So, but you keep going toward understanding what this theory is, and that's sort of a Humean point of view toward science. I mean, you're ever reaching for the truth, but the fact of the matter is that you can't actually know that you're there. So but, you know, people keep going because they think they might get it one day. Similarly, you know, with trying to describe the universe.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. We're speaking with Professor of Mathematics and Computer Science at Dartmouth College, Diane Rockmore, about his new book, Stalking the Riemann Hypothesis, The Quest to Find the Hidden Law of Prime Numbers. Dan, what's amazing for non-mathematicians, and again, reading your book, is the hugeness of the numbers, the computations that have to be done to be dealing with this. There's a little section in your book about skews numbers, and I think it really drives it home when you realize that you're dealing with numbers that humongous to try to pin this down. Can we just talk, it's a total digression, I understand, and it's off the main track, but can we just talk about skews numbers
a
bit?
Sure.
What are they? That's one mother number.
Yeah, it is. It is a pretty large number, and in fact, I think by some measures, well, certainly when it was written down, it was the. I think Hardy said it was the largest number that mathematicians have ever found any use for.
Other than infinity,
and you know, and I'm perfectly happy to have the argument about whether or not they found a use for it. So there's this number called the skews number, and it's 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 34.
It's more than the atoms
in the universe. It's more than the protons in the universe, which are a little bigger than the number of atoms in the universe. So
at a certain point, as a mathematician, that's just amazing that you're dealing with numbers that huge.
Yes, and but it comes up in, I mean, so things like this come up in these in what are called asymptotic studies. So something like the primes. The question here is, you know, how many primes are there up to any given point on the number line? So the key now is I've just said up to any given point. So you could say, well, you know, tell me how many there are up to 1,000. How many are there up to 10,000? You know, how many are there up to 1,000,000, and so on and so forth. And what mathematicians are interested in is there a pattern to my answers to these questions? Mm-hmm. You know, when you say 1,000,000 and I tell you something, and I tell you how many primes there are up to that point, you know, you write that down, you keep asking me, and then you look, you know, is there a pattern in those answers? And so there's an exact number, and then you can try to estimate the number. And Gauss, who's a very famous German mathematician of the 18th century, he had an idea of how many primes there should be—a rough idea, not an exact count, and approximation. And so there's Gauss's idea, and then there's the exact count. And Gauss's idea, in fact, it doesn't hit it right on the head, but what Gauss does get is he gets something a little less, and he seemed to always get a number that was a little less than the exact number of primes. And so mathematicians then began to ask the question, well, is Gauss's estimate always a little less? And it took a 20th century mathematician named Skews to discover that, no, in fact, it's not always less. Sometimes it's a little more, other times it's less. But the first time that it's a little more, by his estimate, I mean, the only thing he knew was that finally when you got out to this unbelievably large number, you know, more than the number of protons in the universe, that in fact, yes, they would cross, you know, that Gauss's estimate would be a little bit more. So it's pretty extraordinary to try to think of problems which only come true at a point at which, you know, you're past the number of protons in the universe.
And Skews is operating in time before computers were common?
Yeah, I mean, so his calculation has nothing to do with computers. It's totally what a mathematician would call an analytic derivation. He's working explicitly with formulas and again trying to understand in these formulas what happens when you ask the question of what this function is equal to for a very large number. The numbers that we're talking about for Skews are numbers that even, I mean, today's computers can't compute with. You know, quantum computers will never compute out sort of in the realm of Skews number.
And this brings up an interesting point. What I found most fascinating about your book is the last sort of half of or a third of the book is about a search for a connection. So there's this ongoing search for the structure of the zeta zeros to try to find this pattern,
right?
And it'll reveal. And all of a sudden, all these people in quantum theory start thinking that there's a relationship between different aspects of quantum theory and the structure of zeta zeros. And it seems like it could be really, really fruitful. It certainly was exciting to explore. Who started this idea that there was a connection between quantum theory and the search for the large-scale pattern of primes?
Yeah, although the connection is hinted at in some work, in some early 20th century work by David Hilbert and George Polya, I think that most mathematicians today really trace the explosion of research around this to this chance meeting at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton between Freeman Dyson and Hugh Montgomery. Montgomery was a number theorist, is a number theorist, and Dyson is, of course, one of the most famous theoretical physicists of our day. And so Montgomery had been studying some sort of hypothetical properties of these things called the zeta zeros, these things that Riemann had been studying. And so he had some conjectures about the way in which, the patterns, if you like, certain patterns that occurred regarding these zeta zeros. And he and Dyson were introduced to one another at tea at the Institute. And when Montgomery explained what he thought the pattern was between the zeta zeros, Dyson guessed it. And, you know, it's one of those sort of earth-shaking moments, you know, a mathematician says, you know, I've been thinking about this thing, and I think that, and the physicist stops him and says, oh, don't tell me, I'm going to guess it. It goes like this. And so Dyson guessed the structure, or some conjectured structure among the zeta zeros, but Dyson guessed it because he knew something about the way that energy levels in heavy nuclei behave. And then he just had this intuition after hearing the problem that, oh, I bet these things work exactly the same way. And they do seem to work exactly the same way. I mean, here we have a lot of numerical confirmation, and so that there's this resonance or twinning somehow between the zeta zeros and the energy levels of heavy nuclei is a totally amazing thing. And from this, it's allowed physicists to quote unquote play in the field of number theory. And it's really where I'd say, so much of the interesting late 20th century and now 21st century work on the Riemann hypothesis has started.
I want to just explain a term in here that
sure.
if people find quantum theory to be difficult, and I forget who it was who said that anybody says that they understand quantum theory, they don't understand quantum theory.
Certainly every physics teacher.
I'm just blanking on his name right now, but he was a very famous physicist said that, but there's something called quantum chaos, and that's relating to this, to the chaotic dynamical systems. When they say quantum chaos, what are they talking about?
So chaos is now a familiar term out in the general world, and that's chaos, roughly speaking, is sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So We all can see that in our own lives. You know, the story about the person who just missed the bus by 3 minutes, and then it was in an accident down the street. But so So chaos, so chaotic systems are systems that have this kind of behavior, that things can change dramatically if the starting conditions are even off by a little bit. And chaos is something that, well, we believe to be true of the macroscopic world. So the world that we see with our own eyes is a world in which we see chaos. Now, in the quantum mechanical world, which is the world inside the atom, which we can't see, generally speaking, physicists didn't believe that there was this sort of possibility for disorder. I mean, that's one of the ironies about quantum mechanics, that for all the for all the chance that does go on in the atom, and in fact, quantum mechanics is described in a probabilistic or statistical way, in fact, it exhibits some extraordinary regularity. So physicists have always believed that, all right, quantum mechanics means regularity in the atom, and the macroscopic world means chance in this funny way, even though, again, you would think it's the other way around. And quantum chaos is what happens when you take a chaotic system in the macroscopic or real or sort of world that we see, and then begin to shrink it in some way. So imagining that this chaotic phenomenon occurs in a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller place until finally it's this chaotic thing that's been shrunk, if you like, to a microscopic, submicroscopic level, and all of a sudden it's supposed to be orderly. But there's something on the transition between this disordered beginning and this orderly end, and that transition place is the phenomenology of that weird transition place is called quantum chaos.
And as you mentioned in the book, it's in that hinterlands where all the excitement and interesting stuff happens, and that's where it relates to the large-scale structure of the Zeta Zeros.
Yeah, I mean it's a long story.
But that's why you need to read the book.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. I hope it's one that's understandable. But it's one of these classic scientific phenomena where you look in the borderland, you know, between two areas that you think you understand so well, but in the border, all these mysterious and amazing things happen. And that's, I mean, in the world of, in our world, it's the world of quantum chaos where people are trying to understand phenomena that's related to quantum computers, which are these sort of next generation machines, and now also the primes. So all sorts of amazing and amazing phenomena.
We have only 1 minute left, but do you think after the construction of quantum computers that the solution of the structure of the Zeta Zeros will be solved?
My guess is no. But
hedging your bets, Dan?
Yeah, well, I mean that's my guess, but you know, quantum so a quantum computer has not a real working one hasn't been built yet. And when the theoretical and engineering problems have been overcome, to be honest, there's no telling what, you know, people will have had to discover in order to make that happen.
Right.
So, you know, certainly a better understanding of how to build a quantum computer is going to affect how people view the relevance to the Riemann hypothesis. So, you never know. That's science. You think you know, and then you don't know.
It's science and mathematics, and that's what I found fascinating about the last sections of your book, is it's this very strange area where science, where physics, theoretical physics, and math are really overlapping and feeding each other information, and it's a fascinating time to be involved in both fields.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I say in the book, it's really a time when I think mathematicians really think that, I mean, all mathematicians can believe that they have something to say about the Riemann hypothesis and even about various aspects of physics, and conversely, you know, scientists from all other disciplines can weigh in on this very old and amazing problem.
We're completely out of time. You've been listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. We've been speaking with Professor of Mathematics and Computer Science at Dartmouth College, Dan Rockmore, about his new book, Stalking the Riemann Hypothesis, The Quest to Find the Hidden Law of Prime Numbers. Dan, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
This is Mark Lynch for Inquiry. Good night.